Former Trump campaign aide George Papadopoulos was the first person charged in special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. He is the author of the new book, Deep State Target: How I Got Caught in the Crosshairs of the Plot to Bring Down President Trump. Papadopoulos was working as a foreign policy advisor for Donald Trump's presidential run. He pled guilty in October 2017 to lying to the FBI about his communications with two Russian nationals and a Maltese professor with Russian ties while working on the campaign. Again, the name of the book is Deep State Target, and we welcome George Papadopoulos to the roundtable this morning. Thank you for being with us. I appreciate you.
Thank you for having me.
Being on the program. Why do you believe that there is a plot to bring down the president?
That's a great question. It starts very simply with candidate Trump's open proclamations and declarations about working with Russia at a geopolitical level. What happened essentially was that, and as you can see in my book, Deep State Target, many members of the Trump campaign and associates of the president and even the president himself were targeted for one major reason, and that was for what the intelligence agencies and the FBI under Comey and Bob Mueller thought were suspicious links to foreign governments. As there's been tremendous misunderstanding and disinformation out there about what my case really was all about, and it had to do with a FARA violation regarding my relationship or alleged relationship with the government of Israel. Michael Flynn had the same charge thrown at him regarding the state of Turkey, Paul Manafort with Ukraine, and obviously Donald Trump with Russia. So the overarching theme of why I believe the deep state was targeting the president and his team was for the simple fact that they did not like the coziness or the apparent coziness of various members of his team and him with certain governments around the world. And I explained that in vivid detail in my book.
Can we agree that there was Russian interference in our election in 2016?
I believe that every 4 years, the most highly watched and anticipated event in the world is not the World Cup and it's not the Olympics, but it's the presidential campaign season. So, of course, both friends and foes of the United States will do everything in their power to do two things. One, meddle, or two, have at least an inside door, inside peek into the scenes and the structure and the policies being formulated behind the scenes. Now, do I think that Russia attempted to meddle? Yes. Do I also believe that U.S. allies meddled, like the U.K. and Australia, as I explained in my book? Absolutely yes, too.
So give us a sense of your work as foreign policy advisor. The time frame being what? You started in the campaign when?
So So here's my, I guess my context with the campaign go back to the summer of 2015. I had been working at the Hudson Institute. It's a conservative think tank in Washington, D.C. for 5 years. Up until the summer of 2015, where obviously the presidential campaign season began. And I reached out to Corey Lewandowski. I think when the campaign was around three people, Hope Hicks, George Gigikos, and Corey Lewandowski. And I told him, hi, Corey, I think I could be a great fit for your campaign. I come from the energy industry. I have a lot of contacts in the Middle East and Europe, and I work here in D.C., and I think I could help you. And Corey, as I explained in my book, reached out very quickly. He responded very quickly, and he said, let's keep in very close touch and see how we can bring you on as the campaign begins to expand. Because I don't even think the campaign at that point knew that they would expand, let alone win the entire election. So I leave Washington. I work as an energy consultant in London for a couple months until I joined the Ben Carson campaign, where I'm working as a foreign policy advisor there for 4 months up until he drops out. And I finally get the final go from Corey and some others on the campaign that they want me to join. And that's when I have my interview in March of 2016.
You remained with the campaign for how long?
So I remained with the campaign through the transition. I was advising both Steve Bannon, who actually introduced me to Michael Flynn, and KT McFarland up until Inauguration Day. Where I had been, attending various parties with people like Reince Priebus and was actively discussing my potential involvement with the administration itself at the National Security Council or the Department of Energy. But that obviously all came to a halt when the FBI came to my door 2 days after the inauguration.
What were they looking for? What did they want to know at that point?
At the point that the FBI came to my home in January, it was quite clear that they had me under the radar for quite some time, potentially even years. And I explained in my book that that radar and the spotlight that was on me was because of my ties to Israel and the Middle East in general, to the extent that I ended up brokering the meeting between Donald Trump and President Sisi of Egypt during the UN General Assembly. So when they came to my home, they wanted to know a lot about those ties. And I was quite shocked because I was under the assumption when I went to speak to them that I wasn't a target of the investigation, that I was there to help them with some sort of national security questions that they might have had. And I soon realized that I was a target for that side, meaning my Middle Eastern ties, and then also the fabricated element of my case, which is what I guess people unfortunately have been fed about me for the last 2 years, and that is about Russian interference.
We know what the charges are. I mentioned what the charges were. What do you believe you did wrong? You pled guilty. What do you believe you did wrong?
Yes. So what happened was that during my last day with the Bob Mueller team, they told me, and I assume they did the same thing to Michael Flynn and others, after they bankrupted me and they bankrupted Michael Flynn and they bankrupted Roger Stone and Jerome Corsi, that, you know what, if you don't plead guilty to lying, we're going to add on further charges against you. And those two further charges against me were a FARA violation, meaning a Foreign Agent Registration Act violation regarding my alleged involvement with the Israelis, and obstruction. So that would have resulted in me probably having to spend $1 million in a trial that I did not have. So what any person does in that situation, you plead out to a lesser charge, which in my case was lying. But what my actual lie was basically a perjury trap, and I could explain what I mean. When the FBI came to my home and I disclosed to them that this Maltese man that you referenced at the beginning of this interview told me that the Russians have thousands of Hillary Clinton's emails, I volunteered this information to the FBI, but the FBI agents interviewing me were not even shocked or moved by this information. And then they began to ask me various perjury trap questions like, okay, so when did you meet this person? And instead of answering that I met him in March, I said April, and they ended up charging me with lying to the FBI because I misremembered or confused dates of when I met this individual. So it just goes to show you of, I guess, the motivations behind this investigation, that they weren't looking to solve a conspiracy or a crime, but what they were actually doing was setting various perjury traps, like they got Michael Flynn on as well and Jerome Corsi, to essentially sing and possibly say something that would incriminate the president himself.
Did you have dirt on Hillary Clinton?
So this is the fascinating part of the entire story and why I believe my book Deep State Target is being very carefully reviewed by members of Congress and even the administration itself currently. The false narrative and the narrative that was promulgated to the American public for 2 years about me was that this Maltese man, Joseph Mifsud, was a Russian spy who told me that the Russians had Clinton's emails over lunch in London. That was what was fed to the media and what Bob Mueller and the FBI told the world. The information that we have now is that this Maltese man, Joseph Mifsud, was never a Russian spy, but was actually working with Western intelligence organizations and under the guidance of the FBI itself when he disclosed that information to me, hence, setting me up and entrapping me in a fake conspiracy. And that's actually why many people now are very curious to see why Congressman Mark Meadows and the president are openly discussing declassifying specific materials regarding my case, because it's going to not only probably help the president's cause, but it's going to reveal the extent that the FBI under Comey and various other intelligence organizations went to create a fake setup that made it look like Donald Trump and the campaign were conspiring with Russia, but we were not.
October 5th, 2017, you plead guilty to making false statements to the FBI. Then on October 31st, 2017, the president writes on Twitter, "Few people knew the young, low-level volunteer named George, who has already proven to be a liar." Your response, immediate response to seeing and hearing about that?
When I saw that, I wasn't shocked, and I probably would have done the same thing if I was the president, because the way my status of offense was written in such a bizarre, manipulative way, it made it seem like I was this incredibly treasonous person who was up to no good and basically was trying to undermine U.S. democracy as a whole. That's how it was written to the layman and to the person looking at it very quickly. So I wasn't shocked that the president responded like that, and he responded like that to other people too who got caught up in this Russia hysteria, including even Michael Flynn, who he said he was a man that barely worked for me, and Paul Manafort the same thing. So it might have been a defense strategy, and I personally didn't take any offense to it, and I'm just looking at the current situation and how people surrounding the president and his allies are responding to me currently now that my true story is coming out. And that's really what I care about now.
But now you're saying nice things about him. And before, when you pled guilty, they said mean things about you. I mean, it seems that it would be of concern to me if you are looking and saying, all right, I did this wrong thing, the president dismisses you, that has to at some level give you pause.
You know, at that point, like I said, the way I was framed and spoken about to the world, I was viewed as really probably the most shady person in history. So, and unfortunately, that's just how I was misrepresented to the world. And look, there are many people who would want to distance themselves from somebody if you're characterized in a faulty manner the way I was. So, yeah, of course, it stung me and it was hurtful, but I understood the logic behind the decision. And I've moved forward from that. And I'm just concerned right now with the truth being revealed and how the president and his allies in the media and in Congress characterized me today, not 2 years ago.
Corey Lewandowski called you a low-level volunteer who might have attended a meeting of the Foreign Policy Advisory Team. The one meeting took place, but he was not a person who was involved with the day-to-day operations of the campaign or a person who I recall interacting with on a regular basis at all. Your role, you write, was much broader than that.
Well, I give facts. And I'm not sure what Corey's reasoning was for saying that, considering I have probably 500 emails between myself and Corey Lewandowski, including emails where we were discussing potentially organizing a trip for candidate Trump to go visit Russia together. So I don't understand why Corey said that. He was fired, I think, in May, while I continued working on the campaign all throughout the transition. And I was working directly with people like Steve Bannon, Michael Glasner, and even Michael Flynn during the transition. So I'll leave it at that.
You served how long in prison?
11 nights.
11 nights. And what was that experience like? I mean, it's easy for me to say that's not a long time, but I'm not serving 11 nights in prison.
Well, going into it, I probably had the same fear that probably 99.9% of good Americans out there have about prison, and that's that you're going to get killed and raped and probably you'd have to join a gang, you know. But fortunately, that's not what happened. I was in mid-America in a great city of Oxford, Wisconsin, where most of the support people there were Trump supporters. They had followed my story carefully. They understood that there was an injustice done in my case. And the facility itself was not like the movies. It was more like a university dorm with bunk beds and no prison cells or bars. And, you know, you could go outside whenever you wanted. So, of course, it was not a nice experience. I would never want anyone to endure what I had to, even for one day, let alone 11. And, of course, I missed my wife, who was in Wisconsin with me the entire time. But it wasn't the worst thing in the world. But certainly it wasn't pleasant either.
You have applied for a pardon.
Yes, my lawyers have formally applied for a pardon. They believe that there's a basis and justification for the president granting me one. I have not personally applied for one. It's a legal matter at this point, and my legal team is dealing with it. I don't have an expectation for a pardon, but if I'm granted one, of course, I would honorably accept it.
When you think about what your future is now, I mean, how much has this tainted you?
You know, initially, I was viewed as a pariah among not only my friends in the conservative world, but also obviously in the liberal world. Now, however, I'm seeing a tremendous upswing in public support for not only myself, but my family, including my wife, among my old friends and friends of the president and in the media, where I'm being hosted on programs like yours, The Hannity Show, Tucker Carlson. I wrote a book. Congressman Mark Meadows is tweeting about me. So I don't think and that this has tainted me, because now that the truth is coming out and people are understanding what I had to go through and how unnecessary this pain is that was inflicted upon America, not only to myself, but to the whole country, that, you know, I've even had people from the Republican Party reach out to me and think it might be a good idea for me to run for Congress eventually. So I haven't closed that door, and we'll see what happens. But right now, that's not in my mind. It's simply getting the story out there, getting the truth out there for America to consume, and just being vindicated in front of the American public.
So, final question, and that is, when it comes to the New York Times reporting of that the Mueller report, that there may be more there than was reported by the Attorney General. I mean, it has to even interest you as to what is in this 400-page or so document, does it not?
Of course it does. But I have to say, when the Mueller report came out, I was laughing, because of course I knew that there would be no Russia conspiracy or collusion, because so much of the investigation was laid on me. And I'm a person who's never met a Russian official in my life, just so you could understand how bizarre the evidence and the situations were surrounding my case and this entire saga. Regarding obstruction, I have, of course, nothing to do with that. And the president himself, you know, has been exonerated even to that extent. The only thing that I could possibly predict that's in this Mueller report that hasn't been revealed to the public is probably the involvement of other countries trying to interfere in the election itself, and to what extent they were successful or not successful. Because, as I stated earlier in this interview, Mueller targeted Trump and his associates, including me, for their alleged ties to foreign governments. In my case, it was Israel. Michael Flynn, it was Turkey. Paul Manafort, it was Ukraine. And others probably had similar fates. So that's the only other thing I could possibly predict would be in this report. Nevertheless, the conclusion is quite clear that there was no collusion and there was no conspiracy with Russia. And that was the entire reason for the Mueller investigation to begin and end.
Well, and it is, in fairness, sir, we don't know that, right? We don't actually know that.
No, that's why I said it was a prediction.
Yeah, a prediction.
Yes.
So you go on. What are you doing now? Besides, you got the book, and then what's the day job?
Yeah, so right now I'm actually working on a docuseries with my wife about our life pre and post Mueller. I'm supporting her as she supported me for the last 2 years. She's an actress here in California, so I'm here supporting her. I just released the book last week. It took me 6 months to write it. And the next step is clearly for me to continue to get the story out there, to redeem myself and repair my image in front of both America and the Republican Party. And hopefully once that happens, I would love to get back into public service and potentially run for Congress myself. But that's a later goal.
The name of the book is Deep State Target, How I Got Caught in the Crosshairs of the Plot to Bring Down President Trump. The name of the publishing company, which probably some will find it amusing, is Diversion Books. maybe they should have thought that through a little bit more. But George, I appreciate you being with us and speaking to us and taking the time.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Deep State Target. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.